attack in history at the Israeli regime, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, the IRGC, more than 10 days and counting since the silence and negligence of international organizations, particularly the United Nations Security Council, in condemning the Israeli regime's acts of aggression and crime of attacking the consular section of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Damascus as part of Iranian territory, which led to the martyrdom of 7 Iranian authorized advisors and failure to punish this criminal regime as stipulated in Clause 7 of the UN Charter. And in response to these crimes and in order to carry out earlier warnings and fulfill Iran's rightful demand, and in order to punish the aggressor, the IRGC devotees, utilizing their strategic intelligence, missile and drone capabilities, attacked key military targets of the terrorist Zionist army in the occupied territories, successfully struck them and destroyed them. As it pursues the strategic policies of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the IRGC hereby announces that, 1. The terrorist U.S. government is warned that any support for and contribution to efforts to deal a blow to Iranian interests will incur a firm response by the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces that will make it regret its action. Moreover, the United States has a responsibility toward the Israeli regime's evil deeds and should accept their consequences if it fails to contain this child-killing regime in the region. 2. While highlighting Iran's good neighbor policy vis-a-vis neighboring and regional countries, we reiterate that any threats by the terrorists, U.S. government, and the Israeli regime made from whichever country will prompt a reciprocal and proportionate response from the Islamic Republic of Iran to the origin of that threat. We assure the heroic Iranian nation that the IRGC and other divisions of the Iranian armed forces will put their lives on the line to secure national interests and thwart the enemy's efforts to disrupt the people's security and tranquility. Again, that is the second statement released by the Iran's IRGC. We're going to cross over to Sydney and talk to Tim Anderson, Director of Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. Tim, thanks so much for being with us. Well, your thoughts in general about what is taking place as we speak?
Look, there are reports still coming in from the IRGC. No doubt you're seeing them, that there are, for example, the military base have been targeted, and, the Nevatim military airport has been completely destroyed. I think something that's worth pointing out here is the moral character of this retaliation. You know, in international law, there's a couple of principles. One has been cited by Tehran, that Article 51 of self-defense. Another one is proportionality, but proportionality in international law has meant that, you know, you don't do a disproportionate response to a particular crime. But many were speculating, oh, perhaps Iran is going to target one of the Israeli embassies somewhere. But it's not really as simple as tit for tat, is it? There's a moral question involved. Because the Israelis have killed thousands of Palestinian children, does that mean that the resistance should kill thousands of Israeli children? No, what's happening is Iran is demonstrating a different level of principle in this, and they are attacking these military bases, the military airports, which give the capacity to the regime to take off and target the children, the civilians they've been killing in Gaza. So I think this message will get through once the dust settles a little bit and we see the real impact of these retaliatory strikes. We will see that if they are indeed very carefully on military bases and there is quite minimal civilian casualty there, we will see a big moral difference between what Iran has done to the Zionist regime and what the Zionist regime has been doing to Gaza and the entire region.
We have seen Iran in dealing with various entities over the years. I mean, if we go back to the 8-year Saddam Hussein-imposed Iraqi war on the Islamic Republic of Iran, I mean, there are very strict, actually, rules and laws that exist Islamically and also were reiterated by the leader of the revolution, of course, Ayatollah Khomeini, Imam Khomeini, and then Ayatollah Khamenei, the same thing. Not even destroying trees, for example, the palm trees, the date trees, in Iraq. They could not attack. They could not attack the cities, even though that that regime had attacked the Iranian cities. There's so many rules and laws because of the morality of it all. There are rules even in war. Of course, the Zionist entity, there are no rules. There are no limitations to how evil that they can be. We have seen infants, newborns being singed to death, being left actually being taken off of their incubators, just left to die. Unbelievable scenes. And I think that definitely tonight, with the retaliatory attack by the Islamic Republic for that attack on its consular section, and also just the overall situation, what the regime has done, that's why we are seeing such showing of happiness and joy from Palestine, the occupied territories, to Iraq, to Lebanon, to Iran, and I'm sure a lot of other places, as people around the world, I believe, have had enough of the bloodshed, enough of the tyranny, and enough of this oppression that's been backed by the hegemonic front. And I know you're in Australia, and over these 6 months, more than 6 months now, we have seen actually lots of activity there, lots of activists taking to the streets and protesting like never before against the Israeli regime. Your thoughts?
Yes, you're right. All around the world, this has had a huge impact, and a huge moral impact too. As we were saying before about the disgrace of the Zionist regime, which had worked so hard to try and build up its image. Remember all those stupid slogans, the most moral army and the only democracy in the region, all these ridiculous slogans. Really, now it's become very clear to the worldwide community, and we're talking Latin America, Asia, Africa, everywhere, the Western world, the global south, that this is the worst of all pariah regimes. Things can never go back to the way that they were. Now you mention here, yes, it's true, we've had 6 months of rallies. Of course, there's been great participation of Palestinian Australians, Lebanese Australians, but also young people. They've been mobilized. They've come out every weekend. And they've come out, and when they come out, they hear speakers and they follow the developments, and they have followed the developments, for example, the resistance in Lebanon doing their part to draw away the genocidal army from Gaza. And so people are saying, well, long live Lebanon. And then the Yemenis, and they didn't know anything about Yemen because, of course, the Western media totally censors that. The Iranian media is one of the few media in the world which talks about the Yemeni people. So now, all of a sudden, because of Gaza, Yemen's image has risen. They don't even know about Yemen, but they think the Yemenis are wonderful people, what they're doing there. Now, today's rally, undoubtedly we'll see more Iranian flags, and there'll be talk about the Iranian role in the region, which was hidden from them, basically, because Iran's been demonized by a series of scare stories for many, many decades.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Of course, if you're just joining us, it has been a very, very busy night. It continues to be so. Over 200 Iranian drones launched against the Israeli regime, and also along with missiles that have been sent. Reports that we were getting were at least 50% have gotten through. We have seen explosions taking place in various towns and cities inside of the occupied territories. And Richard, what we've also seen are just signs of joy, celebrations, whether we're talking about inside of Gaza or Al-Aqsa, as I said earlier, in Iraq, in Lebanon, inside of Iran, and I'm sure inside of Yemen. I haven't seen actually any footage yet inside of Yemen, but we know our Yemeni brothers and sisters have definitely been there every step of the way.
Yeah, without a shadow of doubt, you know, the Yemenis will have the biggest crowds of all. It's just a matter of time till we get the footage. And, you know, I know for a fact that people are still outside now in the streets in Damascus and in Beirut, because it gives them hope. You know, again, we should remember that people are tired. You know, they've had resources stolen from them. Their lives affected by its occupation that never leaves the Americans, the Israelis. They've reduced the quality of life for many people. I remember, for example, in Syria, just before the war, brand new infrastructure being built, no more electricity cuts. The country was getting so good, and then the West and Israel and their allies in the region destroyed it all. Now they've set the country back, and they're doing the same to Lebanon with the de facto U.S. sanctions. They're doing the same to everyone. So when they see these images, it's like they're empowered. You know, this is their liberation. For once, the Israelis get a taste of their own medicine, and not the innocent civilians who just want to live in peace.
Right, right. You know, you made an interesting point because, as an American and growing up and hearing about this part of the world, it's always, it was always projected that those people, they always want war. They always are after conflict. And instead of the beauty of this part of the world and the love between the people and families and the absolute joy for life, as a matter of fact. But as you have said, when you gave an example of Syria, and we have so many others, of how the hegemonic front, especially the United States, has continually tried to destroy these countries, putting under economic pressure or military pressure. I think about, for example, Iran and the sanctions, or Syria and the sanctions, or Lebanon after the bombing and the sanctions and the banks and just continual pressure. But when it's shown to the outside world, I'm talking about basically to the West in general, it is shown that these people are always troubled. They don't want to live in peace. I mean, but I'm hoping that this time around, Richard, that scenario, that narrative has been broken. Because what else we have seen during the last six and a half months, as Muslim men have always been demonized, we have seen these strong Muslim men and holding their babies and digging through dirt with their bare hands, trying to find their women, their sisters, their wives, and the love of family. All of what had been basically shown in a totally negative way, I think that this last 6 months have at least shown the reality to those who want to see.
Inshallah, God willing, because I find it horribly racist, and I'm sure you'd agree with me, how they depict the Middle East, like as if, oh, well, you know, they're a bunch of savages who like to fight. Mm-hmm. No. There's fighting because of the West. Because the West won't leave the region alone. They leave that part out. And then they say, oh, well, it's about religion. No. There's, you know, if Iraq, for example, or Syria, for example, before these wars and invasions, no one cared if you're Sunni or you're Shia. This is not a thing. It doesn't come up. You know, you don't discriminate or think badly or question what faith your neighbor is, because the society, as you said, has a love of life, and they destroyed that. They brought so much death. I honestly look at this at the region, and I tell myself this is evil what they've done. Like truly, the devil himself is as they say, America is the great Satan, and I can only agree. Again. You know, the resistance gives people hope. It gives me hope. And Iran is a very patient country. It has tried to do things diplomatically. Syria, the same thing. But at the end of the day, you know, they think kindness and patience is a form of weakness. And that's not how, you know, we live in this region, how we're taught. It's a very, very different mentality.
Yes, indeed. Richard, let me cross over to San Bernardino, California, and welcome David Yacoubian, Professor of History, California State University, San Bernardino. David, thanks so much for being with me. Well, we've been covering now for hours, rolling coverage and dealing with Iran's retaliatory attacks. I'd like to start off from here, your perspective of what's taking place as we speak.
Thank you, Marzia. And if I might just give a little bit of broader historical perspective, as I was listening to some of your commentators earlier in your conversation and your very excellent questions, I was reminiscing about the title of Nikki Keddie's book about Sayyid Jamal al-Din al-Afghani, who was an advocate of pan-Islamic unity in the late 19th century. And the title of her book is An Islamic Response to Imperialism. And as you were discussing with your guests, the fact that right now, the resistance against Zionism transcends linguistic divisions within the region and certainly sectarian divisions within the region. It I do believe that Syed Jamal Din al-Afghani would be very proud to see what is clearly an Islamic response to imperialism, which has been taking place, very vociferously led by the Palestinians since October 7th, but certainly also now including Ansarullah, Hezbollah, and most importantly, the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Yes, yes. And so just overall, I mean, what has happened tonight, even the Israeli regime itself admitted that the attacks were larger than expected. Your thoughts about that, David? Was this miscalculated? Did the Israeli entity, does it not know the capability of Iran? Or how do you see it?
Well, it's hard to get into the mind of Zionists and imperialists because what they deem to be appropriate or proportional or legal within what we all know they refer to as the rules-based international order, which is essentially the rules that they make up for themselves and to promote their own hegemony. So I don't really know what the Zionists considered would be an appropriate response, but certainly the Islamic Republic of Iran wouldn't respond by hitting a diplomatic mission, considering the fact that this is a gross violation of international law. So I, and I believe many other observers who I had been listening to and reading over the last few weeks, were certain that Iran was going to strike relevant military sites. The exact number, the exact proportion of, you know, drones to ballistic missiles or the methods, of course, that's totally up to the IRGC. But I believe the Zionists made a very, very dramatically poor decision to test the resolve of the Islamic Republic of Iran continually, especially in light of the previous 6 months of genocide being unleashed on the Palestinian people in Gaza. Once the Zionists crossed the line and attacked sovereign territory of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Damascus, whatever they thought might have been the response is essentially too late for that. And I will just add that for the United States and or the British or any other European government to complain about Iran's response, what happened in the United Nations was despicable, and this is that there was not a Security Council resolution condemning what is an obvious violation of international law. This is, in my view, largely their responsibility, and particularly the responsibility of the United States of America, who the world has watched promote, sustain, fund, and give diplomatic cover to, as well as the kinetic material for the ongoing genocide in Gaza.
And with that, brings us to the end of this World News edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Despite a UN report citing testimonies from Palestinians who said they were sexually assaulted and beaten while in the Zionist regime detention, the mainstream Western media has failed to give this issue much attention. Amid Western media silence and local taboos around sexual assault, Palestinian victims are often ignored. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East, I wrote, since October 7th. The Zionist regime has baselessly accused Hamas of committing sexual violence during its incursion. Many mainstream Western media outlets have paid considerable attention to these unsubstantiated allegations. But while reporters must always take such accusations seriously, it is equally important for them to uphold journalistic standards in the process, and there appear to have been serious lapses in that regard. At the same time, allegations involving Palestinian women in Gaza have received far less airtime. Despite a UN report citing testimonies from Palestinians who said they were sexually assaulted and beaten while in the Zionist regime detention, the mainstream Western media has failed to give this issue much attention. In addition to the UN report, there are many documented cases of Palestinian women who described sexual abuse at the hands of Israeli forces. Detainees reported being stripped, beaten, searched, and threatened with rape. Despite all the documented cases of sexual assault, however, the Zionist regime has used a single incident to refute them all. After Al Jazeera recently covered an eyewitness account of the rape of a Palestinian woman by Israeli regime forces at Ashifa Hospital, the network backtracked upon learning the claims were fabricated, with the former managing director saying the woman had misled people to provoke an emotional response. The reports came amid the Zionist regime's latest raid on the hospital, which martyred hundreds of people and left Ashifa complex in ruins. After the report was debunked, Israeli regime Foreign Minister Israel Katz suggested that the UN was wrong to take any such report seriously, posting on X, "Look surprised, the Palestinians fabricated stories of rape to incite anti-Semitism." This is a dangerous position considering that the United Nations and other human rights groups have recorded myriad other incidents of sexual assault and humiliating treatment of Palestinian women by the Zionist regime troops. Yet, for a couple of reasons, such testimonies often do not see the light of day. All of this has left us in a situation where the Zionist regime, despite being accused of sexual violence in the ongoing war on Gaza, continues to benefit from the silence of mainstream Western media and sometimes the silence of the victims themselves. Meanwhile, Press TV wrote, "The use of sexual violence against Palestinian women is an integral part of the political history of the Zionist colonial entity since its foundation in 1948. Prominent historians such as Ilan Pappe have documented that during the establishment of the Zionist regime known as the Nakba, the Israeli army engaged in numerous rapes, both collective and individual, against Palestinian women. In this context, the tragic story of a young Palestinian woman who was abducted and raped in the Negev by about 20 Israeli settlers and troops stands out as part of a celebration which ended in her being shot dead. The majority of archives and historical documents from the Nakba era have been deliberately eliminated in an attempt to erase incriminating evidence. Additionally, Palestinian oral history regarding the atrocities committed by Zionists has largely been discredited and deemed an unreliable source with historical research. This is compounded by the stigma surrounding sexual violence, which has led to silence and the concealment of these crimes. Several historians have confirmed how, since the beginning of the last decade, teams from the regime's war ministry have been examining archives and removing historical documents. These documents range from information related to Israel's nuclear program to matters concerning the Zionist colonies' foreign relations. As noted, They also include thousands of documents from the Nakba period and the early years of the colony's existence. Overall, the majority of the removed documents seek to conceal massacres, the destruction of small villages, the expulsion of Palestinian Bedouins, and the numerous instances of sexual violence committed against Palestinian women. The use of sexual violence should not be considered as something peripheral to the Zionist colonial project, but rather constitutes a central part of it. For example, David Ben-Gurion, a key figure in the Zionist movement and the first premier of the Zionist regime, documented in his diary the practices of sexual violence against Palestinian women and girls, whom he considered a threat to the survival of the Zionist colony. Ben-Gurion also contributed to spreading a vision that criminalizes the fertility of Palestinian women, viewing it as an obstacle to the permanent eradication of the native population. The connection between the past and the present is evident when we recall the words of former Israeli minister Eilat Shaked, who stated in 2014, when she was a parliamentarian, that Palestinian mothers should be killed. She stated, "Behind every terrorist, there are dozens of men and women who support him, without whom he could not carry out his acts of terror. They are all enemy combatants, and the responsibility for their actions will rest on their heads. This includes the mothers of the martyrs, who bid them farewell with flowers and kisses towards hell. They should follow the path of their sons, as nothing would be fairer. They should leave, just like the homes where they raised these snakes. Others, new snakes, will continue to be raised in those same places," unquote. The use of sexual violence also occurs in Israeli regime prisons, which has been widely documented. More recently, the Euromed Human Rights Monitor published new testimonies by female Palestinian detainees from Gaza about being subjected to sexual violence, torture, inhuman treatment, strip searches, sexual harassment, etc. While it is true that both men and children are subjected to such treatment, it is women who suffer the most horrendous abuse, scarring them for life. Palestinian women who have been through Israeli regime prisons have recounted their experiences of torture and sexual harassment by regime forces in order to extract confessions. An example of sexual abuse and harassment, one among many, could be seen in the leaked video of the interrogation by young Palestinian activist Ahd Tamimi. Tamimi, who was 16 years old at that time, was arrested during a nighttime raid for kicking and slapping an Israeli regime troop. During her interrogation, recorded on video, it was evident how she was sexually harassed and physically intimidated by her interrogators. The constant threat against women is a reality faced daily by Palestinian women living under colonial occupation. A striking example of this routine violence was evident in the repeated attacks perpetrated at the Al-Aqsa Mosque by both settlers and occupying military forces. The sexual violence inflicted upon Palestinian women since at least 1948 is considered a vital method for protecting the colonial entity. This is because, in the Zionist colonial project, both land and bodies are perceived from a racial perspective that seeks to ethnically cleanse the native population.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, reciting du'as as a part of our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, an honor to be here at your service A to Z. So, dear friends, we are talking about how du'as, supplications, prayers is another way to translate it, how these supplications should be and must be a part of our Islamic lifestyle. So, of course, you know, every single day we move farther and farther away from the holy month of Ramadan. And so while we are moving away from the holy month of Ramadan, we should not move away from the Ramadan lifestyle that, you know, we were living. And we said in the holy month of Ramadan back then that this is really an Islamic lifestyle. So one of the things that we were doing, you know, in that holy month was the recitation of du'as and supplications, right? And this is something that is incredibly important, right? We are talking about an Islamic lifestyle, you know, in the modern day, in the present day. And what is really necessary are these du'as. You know, many times we kind of recite these du'as, we don't really read the translations, we don't read the meaning, we don't contemplate over the meaning. You know, and that's kind of a disservice to these du'as. And on the other hand, we don't really, you know, realize the essence of these du'as. What are these du'as? What are these supplications? What are these prayers, you know, that at least we were doing in the holy month of Ramadan, and we want to continue now as we move farther down the line. These du'as and these supplications and these prayers are in reality a conversation with the Almighty Allah. It is us speaking to Allah. Now, you can speak to Allah in any language, in any form that you want, but, you know, that's good. But these prescribed du'as from the, you know, Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi and the divinely appointed Imams alayhi wa sallam, these du'as are a very beautiful and ultimate summit of how one should converse with the Almighty Allah. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about du'as in our Islamic lifestyle. We had talked about how du'as, in essence, are a conversation with the Almighty Allah. And we said that you can do du'as in any language. But the du'as that have been prescribed to us by the infallibles, alayhim as-salam, the 14 infallibles, we find that those du'as and those prayers and supplications are in reality the peak and the summit of a conversation with the Almighty Allah. So, you know, we were reciting du'as. We had made it a part of our Ramadan lifestyle. And now we want to continue that into our regular lifestyle, even though the Ramadan lifestyle is really the epitome of the Islamic lifestyle. It's not like they're two different things. It's one thing. And matter of fact, the Ramadan lifestyle is the summit of the Islamic lifestyle. So reciting du'as is a part of what we should be doing now as well. Now, like we said, is just merely reciting the du'as. That is good. That has effects, right? That has a certain positive spiritual impact upon us. Yes, it does. But what has even more of a spiritual impact upon us is reciting the translation, reading the translation, reading the meanings. And then a level above that is to try to think about those meanings that are found within that du'a. So what that does is that creates a spiritual transformation within us. We begin to be transformed, our mind, our worldview, you know, our decision-making process, the way we look at Allah, the way we look at the world, all of these are impacted by these du'as. And so definitely something that we should make a part of our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio, Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
When Israeli occupation forces invaded the Gaza Strip, the territory was divided into two halves, north and south, and Palestinians were separated as well. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, 6 months of relentless bombardment on the Gaza Strip have martyred and wounded over 110,000 people, displaced nearly 2 million out of the 2.3 million inhabitants of the Gaza Strip, and destroyed most of Gaza's residential buildings and infrastructure. But there is one dire consequence of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza that is rarely discussed. Many Palestinian families were divided and cannot be reunited under these horrific circumstances. The Palestine Chronicle spoke with three people who were separated from the rest of their families throughout 184 days of war. Their only hope is to be reunited with their beloved ones soon. Loy Haji told the Palestine Chronicle, "I used to live with my family in the village of Al-Maghra, in central Gaza, on the northern border of Wadi Gaza. At the beginning of the war, my wife and children went to her family's house in Gaza City out of fear of Israeli bombardment." Haji continued, "When Israeli occupation forces invaded the Gaza Strip, the territory was divided into two halves, north and south, and we were separated." He said, "Currently, I am displaced in a tent in Deir al-Balah, while my wife and children are still in Gaza City. I have no information about them as communications are almost cut off in Gaza City." Haji said in tears, "I miss my three children and my wife. I cannot wait to be together under one roof. It's been 5 months since I last saw them, 5 months without hearing my children's voice. I can't sleep thinking about them. I don't even know if they were targeted by an Israeli bombardment." Haji told the Palestine Chronicle that he constantly follows the news to get some information. He said, with a voice that grew more desperate as he spoke, "All I know is that they evacuated to my wife's family home on Sahaba Street in central Gaza City. From the news, I learned that the area was subjected to heavy shelling as Israeli airstrikes hit all areas in the Gaza Strip. I hope to reunite with my family and see them soon. Umm Qasim al-Daya used to live in the Nusayrat camp in central Gaza since he got married, while her family lived on Al-Thalathini Street in Gaza City. After the war, she evacuated with her husband's family to Deir al-Balah, then returned to al-Nusayrat camp about a month ago. Since the end of the temporary ceasefire on December 1st, she had no news about her family. Adaya said in tears, "My husband tries to calm me down, telling me that my family is fine, but I know he's lying to me because he doesn't know anything about them." She continued, "I try to call them repeatedly, but there is no network in Gaza City, and I was not able to reach them." Youssef Kowaik stayed in Gaza City as long as he could. He refused to leave the city where he was born and raised. However, when the Israeli regime bombing intensified, Kowaik's wife decided to send their three daughters and their only son to her family house in Nusayrat in central Gaza. When the situation in Nusayrat worsened, they all evacuated to tents in Rafah City. Kowaik told the Palestine Chronicle, "I occasionally check on them, but it is not easy to communicate." He continued, "The phone network is unavailable in Gaza City, while the internet is only available in limited areas. In any case, it is extremely weak." Kowaik knows that in the overpopulated city of Rafah, there are no services, no food, and no medicine. He continued, "I fear for my children from these difficult living conditions. The occupation threatens to invade Rafah every day, and I'm worried about these threats. I don't know where my wife will take my children if the occupation forces enter." Kowaik said in tears, "I hope the war ends soon, and I can reunite with my family. I miss hugging my children." Kowaik, however, wanted to let the Palestine Chronicle know that he did not lose hope. He concluded, "This is the hardest war we've been through, but with our resilience, we will prevail and we will overcome all these hardships."
Welcome to the Israeli Watch. Several topics have been the focus of Zionist media, the most prominent being Israel's apparent failure in achieving its objectives after 6 months of war, ongoing negotiations in Cairo, as well as continuing protests against Netanyahu, with polls indicating Gantz's continued progress. In addition to the anxiety among Zionists about Iran's response to the attack on the consular affairs section of the Iranian embassy in Damascus. I'd like to go ahead and welcome our guest today, military and strategic analyst, General Hisham Jaber. Welcome, General.
Thank you.
After 6 months, the occupation failed to achieve its objectives. Neither Hamas was weakened, nor were the captives or the displaced from the south and north able to return, and resistance rockets continue to fall on the Gaza Strip. The failure to achieve the objectives was accompanied by a failure to return the Zionist displays from the south and north to them. A poll showed that most displaced people will not return to the settlement before Hamas is destroyed and Hezbollah is pushed away from the borders. So, General, as we saw in the Hebrew media, do you believe the Zionist war on Gaza indeed has now ended in failure?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you have to listen to the press conference who made the chief of staff last Sunday. He did recognize that Israel was defeated. Why defeated? When the army cannot achieve any goals and have a lot of casualties and loss, means was defeated. They didn't achieve any goals. Tactical goals were liberate the hostages, POW, destroy tunnels or last found them, and liberate, and block Hamas potential, military potential. They did not achieve any goal. Well, and strategic goal, yes, was to evacuate Gaza from its population.
Well, what about the Zionist entity's northern front? What do you believe is on the horizon there?
Say again?
On the northern front with Lebanon.
Northern front, they have big problem. They cannot stay at this in this situation. They have two pressure, and first of all, the displaced people, 100,000, who lost, and we saw them. Second, there is 45 soldiers and officers, at least three divisions. They are in top, you know, ready, alert for 6 months. It's heavy, and it's in case of peace, you know, it's not normal on the military life. How there is under pressure and fighting. And third, they have casualties every day, hemorrhage they call it. So they cannot stay in this situation. They have to make such breakthrough to go out of that loose cycle.
Yes.
They try to provoke Hezbollah to start the big war.
General, it seems that the majority of Zionists prefer Netanyahu and his government to go and hold early elections. What are the implications of this, do you believe?
They cannot do it.
Why? And
according to their constitution, you know, the government cannot be replaced or changed or any new election, only if this government will be self-destruction,
yes,
or resign money from their members or something like this. Netanyahu, for this reason, doesn't want...
And this might happen?
I will continue. Netanyahu doesn't want any agreement in Cairo because in case of ceasefire or any agreement, maybe it will be renewed for a few weeks or 1 month or more. In this case, they can make election, new election. Everybody ask for new election. But we cannot make election in case of war.
Well, how reliable are these opinion polls, in your opinion? Do they actually reflect what they want for their Zionist leaders?
Netanyahu prefers to be, because if Netanyahu will go, if they make election, Netanyahu will lose his seat. Everybody knows this. If he loses the seat, he will go somewhere else.
Yes.
Everybody knows. He has interest personally with his team to stay in the power, to continue the war, not to have any break or any armistice or any agreement, you know, to stop the fire. That's clear, making clear. Maybe he, under the pressure, of the society, and especially the families of the hostages.
So he'll continue to go ahead and ask from the Americans, correct?
Yes, he has interest to continue the war and ask the help of the United States of America. The same case, why he's doing, he want to go out, he want to go and choose another battlefield out of Gaza and out of Palestine and ask the American for help.
Well, with that,
for
General,
this case, he's trying to provoke Hezbollah.
Well, General, is the Zionist entity in a state of unprecedented civil strife or conflict?
Military?
Yes.
Point of view. He cannot, you know, open another front. Gaza, very small. And they said that...
But what I mean, General, the people here, as we've seen, they have become violent. Yes. And now, as we saw, they're actually attacking each other now. Is this going to cause infliction and problems inside?
A risk of civil war.
Yes.
I think it's the beginning, you know. It's first time in history we find the people that with this divergence, you know, and with this aggressivity, they are aggressor, they became against each other.
So we expect the attacks to continue?
Of course. Of course it will continue, I think. Especially when... will arrive to the end without any success, they have to admit that they have been defeated. They have to build up a, you know, a court, a trial, and you will see a big change in the history of this Kayan Zionist.
The families of the captives participating in the protest demonstrations against Netanyahu hold him responsible for the failure to reach a swap deal and accuse him of sacrificing their children for his personal political interests. Well, General, to what extent are the protests of these Zionist captives' family actually going to be pressuring Netanyahu to conclude a swap deal, in your opinion?
I'm not sure they will agree. As I told you, Netanyahu doesn't have any threat. He did promise them, and I heard him last week said, my prime interest and to do. He said this 5 months ago. He did not, you know, he doesn't care to save the hostages. He's interested to bring their body after they have been killed. It's according to their, you know, religion, to their belief, to
yes.
their... From 8 October until now, 73 hostages were killed by Israeli fire. Everybody knows this. But he will not save them. He is not interested to save them. He has other interests. What is the other interest? Is to stay in the power.
Do you believe that Washington is capable of imposing its proposals in negotiations on Washington? On Netanyahu, excuse me.
Capable or not capable, this the question. But Washington is making a lot of pressure. What Washington is interested to have a ceasefire, because Washington has a pressure from inside, it has a pressure from outside, and even the allies of United States. When you hear that 25 countries from European Union are with the ceasefire.
Including Britain,
Britain, Britain, yes, even Britain, why Britain? Under the pressure of the population, the public opinion, especially after the massacre of the International Central Kitchen.
Yes. Hezbollah's leader, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, has delivered his second speech in days addressing the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, describing the attack as the biggest Israeli escalation against the IRGC. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, was Israel of the repercussions of the attack during a visit to Damascus. I would like to go ahead and thank our guest today, military and strategic analyst General Hisham Jaber, for joining us today. Thank you very much, General. Until next time, salam.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new study has found that G20 countries have spent $142 billion in 3 years to expand operations in fossil fuels, despite a G7 pledge to stop doing so. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The world's biggest economies have continued to finance the expansion of fossil fuels in poor countries to the tune of billions of dollars, despite their commitments on climate change. The G20 group of developed and developing countries and the multinational development banks they fund put $142 billion into fossil fuel developments overseas from 2020 to 2022, according to estimates compiled by the campaigning groups Oil Change International and Friends of the Earth United States. Canada, Japan and South Korea were the biggest sources of such finance in the 3 years studied, namely 2020, 2021 and 2022. Natural gas received more funds than either oil or coal. The G7 group of biggest economies, to which Japan and Canada belong, pledged in 2022 to halt overseas funding of fossil fuels. But while funding for coal has rapidly diminished, finance for oil and natural gas projects has continued at a strong pace. Some of the money is going to other developed countries, including Australia, but much of it is to the developing world. However, richer middle-income countries still receive more finance than the poorest countries. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. The world's biggest economies are continuing to finance the expansion of fossil fuels in poor countries, and they're spending hundreds of billions of dollars in doing so despite their commitments to climate change. The G20 group of developed and developing countries and the multilateral development banks that they fund have put as much as $142 billion into fossil fuel developments overseas in the years 2020, 2021 and 2022. The countries found to be the biggest source of finance by Canada, Japan and South Korea, according to the campaigning groups Oil Change International and Friends of the Earth. The G7 group of biggest economies have also pledged in 2022 to halt overseas funding of fossil fuels. But, nonetheless, the study found that funding for oil and gas projects has continued apace. The most recent G7 pledge in the study is to phase out all overseas fossil fuel funding by the end of 2022. Oil Change International study concentrates on the period from the beginning of the fiscal year 2020-2021 for each country to the end of the fiscal year 2022-2023. However, the researchers also found that Japan had continued to make new fossil fuel investment overseas in the past few weeks, up to mid-March 2024, exploiting loopholes in its promise to end fossil fuel funding.